The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this December 26th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. If you haven't already, I encourage you to follow us on iTunes. We are on, if you search under Writers on Writing, you will get notifications when we podcast new shows. Some of our past shows are up there. Probably all of our past shows are up there. You can also follow us on Facebook. We're under Writers on Writing, KUCI-FM. You can follow us at KUCI in general on Facebook, KUCI-FM. And Barbara's website, penonfire.com, mindmariestone.com. So there's no reason not to hear us. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, on this post-Christmas morning, doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, regardless of whether it's Christmas or not. That is chatting with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. Both authors this morning were pre-recorded. We decided to give them the holidays off, but they were with me a couple of weeks ago. Leanne Moriarty is up first, and in the second half, I'm going to be chatting with Mark Russell Gillade, an amazing new debut short story collection, kind of flash fiction collection. We all know how I love those. But first up, Leanne Moriarty. Leanne Moriarty is the Australian author of the number one New York Times bestsellers Truly Madly Guilty, Big Little Lies, and The Husband's Secret, the New York bestsellers What Alice Forgot and The Last Anniversary, and The Hypnotist's Love Story. Her latest is Nine Perfect Strangers, published by Flatiron Books. Big Little Lies was adapted into an HBO series. Film rights have been optioned for a few of the others, including Nine Perfect Strangers. We're going to chat about all of that. Leanne, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I have been looking forward to having you on for a few books now, but I always knew there'd be another one coming soon, so I didn't get too worked up, but I'm glad we're finally here together.
I'm very pleased to be here.
So I feel like you, better than most, better than many others, have tapped into something in your readership. I mean, beyond the good story and the relatable characters, maybe that is it, but it just feels like you've made some intimate connection with your audience. And I wonder, well over half a dozen books in, if you've sort of spent time reflecting on that, on what kind of it is about these books that's what it's tapping into in your readers, because it's almost universal for all of them.
I must admit I don't like to think about that too much, because if I think about it, I'll feel that I'll try too hard to do it again or to fake it. But I absolutely appreciate it in when I meet readers and when they talk about what my books mean to them or how they've got them through a difficult time, and they often say, I feel like you're reading my mind. But mm-hmm. as I say, although I love hearing it at the moment, I feel like it's really important for me to put it quickly, very quickly, out of my own head, mm-hmm. And not dwell on it, and to just write as honestly and authentically as I can.
That's probably the answer right there. The honesty and the authenticity, right?
Maybe you're right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. These, and all of them, including this latest, are so visual and so kind of cinematic. I don't, you know, it's not surprising to me that they're on HBO or the big screen. And I was kind of wondering if your author brain works sort of cinematically, if you see these things very visually as you're writing them.
You know what, I don't think that I do. I actually feel that as a reader, I see things more clearly than when I'm writing. And I feel like I shouldn't admit that, but that's somehow a failing on my behalf. But, for example, in my book, The Hypnotist's Love Story, there's a house on a beach, and I always feel that writing about a house or writing about actually setting in general is not my strength. And with that house in particular, I felt that I had to fake it, that I really didn't see it that clearly. So it's a house with a sort of 70s style, and I remember I was just Googling images of 70s houses. Just for, you know, it's just described in a couple of paragraphs, but it's amazing to me how many readers have come up and said, I love that house in A Hypnotist's Love Story, and I feel like they can see it more clearly than I can. So that to me always shows how it's the reader's imagination that has to work in tandem with my imagination, and sometimes I feel like theirs is stronger than mine with particular scenes.
That is so funny, because one of my follow-up questions later on in the interview was going to be, the setting almost feels like a character in this book. We'll put a pin in that, but that, that is so funny to hear you
yes,
say.
Yes, but that for me, as I say, I just feel that's, and I would never say that about my own books, that, oh, yes, the setting was like another character. To me, the setting is always just by the by, and so I always feel I've got to cover up my own weakness there. That's the characters that I enjoy writing about.
That's funny. So I wonder if that is sort of a product of, you see that in yourself, it sounds like, as a weakness, and so your internal need to compensate for it may make it to the reader one of your greatest strengths. I mean, I wonder if that's true.
Wouldn't it be lovely if life worked out,
right?
Like that? if that's the case, I don't know. But I often, so for example, there's a house in Nine Perfect Strangers, a sort of historic house, and I remember saying to my husband, you have to help build this house for me. I'd tell me what it would have. I'd just go completely blank when it comes to, I can't even think now of the ceilings or the...
Kind of the architecture.
You know, yeah, the windows and that sort of thing. What have I got to have? So yes, but maybe you're right. I get away with it anyway.
Right. Well, let's dive into that. So I'm going to let you introduce, for those who haven't yet picked it up, Nine Perfect Strangers. Kind of take us into this world, and that'll lay the foundation for our chat here.
Sure. So it's Nine Perfect Strangers is about a formerly best-selling romantic novelist called Frances Welty, who is at a difficult time in her life. She's suffering from a bad back, a broken heart, and a painful paper cut. And she decides to sign up for a 10-day transformation retreat at a remote health resort. And she's joined there by eight other strangers. So there are nine people all together who are doing this retreat, and they think it's going to be about mindfulness and meditation and some hot stone massages, but it obviously turns out to be a rather different experience than what they thought they'd signed up for.
So talk a little bit about the point of origin for you and kind of how the book announced itself to you, if it was through character or through circumstance.
It all came about because of a joke that I was making when I was on tour, actually, for Big Little Lies. So people would always ask, what's your next book going to be about? And I would say, my next book's going to be set on a tropical island resort, and I'm going to have to do a lot of research to get it right, a lot of meticulous research. But the more I started making the same joke, the more I started to think, actually, why not? A tropical island resort would be a perfect setting for a book. I wrote a couple of chapters of a book set with the tropical island resort. A few attempts. I think if I look at my computer, there's a couple of documents with attempts at that book. But then something happened to me at a barbecue, which was what inspired Truly Madly Guilty, so I put it all aside. And then I was on my way home from the book tour for Truly Madly Guilty, and I was in Hawaii, and there was a crisis because I ran out of books, and I found a book left by a previous guest at this hotel where we were staying, and it was, I've worked out now that it was Miss Pym Disposes by Josephine Tay, a British mystery writer, and I just loved that book. It was actually about a writer, so I was clearly very influenced by it, but she was a psychologist. She'd written a book about psychology, and she goes off to a school for gymnasts. And what I especially loved about this was just the feeling that I was going to the school myself and learning about all the procedures of the school and, you know, when the bell rings for breakfast and that sort of thing. And I thought, I want to write a book exactly like that, where somebody goes off somewhere and you learn all the routines and procedures of the place. So that's when my tropical island resort became a health resort. And I took two of the characters who I had in that first chapter of the of the tropical island, and I sent them off to the health resort along with my novelist. So it all went from there.
I've been talking to writers who have been writing about writers. Andre Dubuis just did a book with a writer was one of the characters. And it might be kind of cathartic, I think, for writers to write about writers, because you get kind of all of your angst of, you know, Frances has had a bad review and she doesn't know what's coming next.
this was the first time I did it. So there were two parts to it. First of all, there was that I understood her world. So I've never written about a writer. I had a cellist in Truly Madly Guilty, so I had to interview cellists, and I had hypnotherapist in the Hypnotist Love Story, so I had to go off and get myself hypnotized. So it was actually a great relief to understand just the structure of her world. And then, as you say, there were also all the fun parts of, talking about literary versus commercial fiction, because I have her as a genre writer. And also then I had a lot of fun with just playing with the idea as if this might be a book that Frances herself has written. So I've got lots of little references to, sort of meta mm-hmm. references, little jokes that not every reader will see, but I think all the writers will see those little references and hopefully enjoy them.
Right. My guest this morning is Leanne Moriarty. The book Nine Perfect Strangers is what we're talking about this morning. So there are a lot of, as the title would suggest, there's a lot of point of view characters. In addition to the nine guests, you know, there's kind of a cast of characters that work there. And so let's talk a little bit about character and point of view. And because I always wonder if it's easier or harder on writers to be managing this kind of number of points of view and keeping track of characters. I'm trying to think back on your other novels if you've tackled that big of a cast of characters and points of view before, but kind of talk about that experience.
I do always seem to have multiple points of view, and I actually feel bad about that because I know that sometimes readers complain about finding it hard to keep track of my characters. And so with this book, it really was my intention to only write from Frances's point of view, so to write my first book from one character's point of view. Because I understand as a reader, when sometimes you're reading from one character's point of view and you're liking the character and then you turn the page and you think, oh no, I want to stay with that character. So as a reader, I actually prefer... books where it's set from one perspective, but as a writer, I can't seem to stop myself from jumping into another character's head, because it's such a thrill for me to then be able to describe this one character from the other character's point of view. So originally I thought, okay, well, I'll just do from one other's, just from the resort director, from Nash's point of view. And then I did just one more, and then before you knew it, I had all those multiple perspectives, and so I'd gone way the other way. It's like going on a diet and all of a sudden gorging myself on chocolate or something.
Which also happens in the book. So let's just talk about how you do that, how you manage these people, kind of what your office looks like, if you've got, pieces of butcher paper all over the place trying to keep track of these people, and kind of who may have given you the most trouble of this cast of characters, if there was a character who was really difficult to access, and kind of how you went about that.
So I don't have a systematic approach at all. I just, no spreadsheets or butcher paper or anything like that. I'm always really interested in reading other writers' processes. And so I know, for example, that Anne Tyler has index cards and puts all the index cards on the floor, I believe. So I actually went out and bought myself index cards. But I don't understand that we use the index cards to write notes to each other. Now, for me, I just have a Word document, and I don't do anything particular with the Word document, except that as I'm writing... The only thing I do is I have a separate document called Things I Need to Fix, because as I'm making it up as I go along and I'm realizing something about the way the story is going, I realize I'm therefore going to need to go back and, signpost this. And once I get to know the character as I'm writing, I think, okay, you'll need to change her reaction to that. And I don't actually, I don't find it that hard. I don't find it that hard to keep their personalities in order in my mind. The thing I'm not good at is keeping a timeline. So that's where probably I should have the butcher paper, but I'm just focusing on the story. And so that's it's in the editing process when my editor's saying, well, I thought this happened on Tuesday, and, you know, what, that's the tricky part in the end, making that all work. And in answer to your question, the most difficult character for me was Masha, so my Russian character. And I got help with her when I found a friend of a friend, a Russian woman, who had some long telephone chats with me. And really, she was just, you know, the stories, some of the stories she gave me. And all of a sudden, Masha came to life for me. So I'm so grateful to her.
Do you think that was because of culture? Like, was she elusive to you
because
of her?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I just didn't. I could sort of see her as somebody who had. Who I'd meet, you know, those beautiful Russian women with that, who have that way of, which is quite different from that. Australians have that, you know, self-deprecating sort of, but that confidence. But I was finding it hard internalizing her thoughts, and it was definitely a cultural thing. And as I say, this woman really, really helped me. And I hope I got it. I got her right. I felt that I understood her by the end.
Yeah. I always think it's interesting talking to writers about whether the characters who are the least similar to them are the, you know, like Frances. I can only say this because she's a writer in the book. Almost might be, some writers would say, more difficult to access the closer biographically they look to the writer, because I don't know if it's harder to look
in
the mirror.
Yes, I agree with you, and sometimes that's the case. So they need to be different enough that you can see them clearly, but not so different that you really don't understand them. So I feel like maybe actors do this too. They take a little piece of themselves and put it into this completely different character. So I have to find something that somehow relates. It's an interesting process. But I get myself worked up about the actual facts of things, so that's why I could never write historical fiction. And I do tend to always set my books in contemporary Sydney, or not that far from Sydney, so these characters go 6 hours north of Sydney. If they're too far away, then I worry too much that I've got the facts wrong.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the sticking points. You're so wonderful at managing suspense. That's something, so plotting in general is really tricky for me. So when I see it done well, I really appreciate it. And so let's talk a little bit about managing suspense and surprise, both for the book itself and for you as writer. So, you know, as you're writing along, do you find yourself saying, oh my God, I never saw that coming? Or, wow, I didn't know she was going to do that. And then that kind of creates the tension and suspense that the reader also comes to enjoy? Or is it pretty carefully planned out before you get into the thing?
I definitely don't plan, so that I do feel that it's got to come as a surprise to me as well as the reader. But then, of course, I can go back once it's done and think, okay, well, you can see the tensions slipping here. I just need to cut this to keep the pace right. But when I'm writing it, I prefer not to know what's going to happen, and that's why I always hate to think that I must always have a twist of some sort in my books, because the twist might not happen. The twist has to creep up on me, and of course it's still me. It's not. I don't like it when writers say that. Although maybe it does happen that way for them, but it doesn't for me, this idea that it's all just pouring in. It's still me making those decisions, but it's a nice surprise when I make certain decisions, or I think, oh, this could work, and that's such a pleasure in that, when you're writing a particular scene, you suddenly think, well, maybe I'll make this happen, and that's a surprise, and hopefully a surprise to the reader as well.
Yeah. I don't know if we can talk about this without giving points of the book away, but kind of a general conversation about getting stuck, sticking points, and digging yourself out of them.
Oh, yes. So I did at one point have, I have my nine strangers in a situation where I had no idea how I was going to get them out of it. And so, yes, sometimes you back yourself into a corner. I just hope that I pulled that off in the end.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I didn't know how to get them out of it. And maybe the plot takes some outlandish turns in order to do that.
So what do you do in those points? Do you put it away for a couple of days and let your brain churn on it? Do you just barrel through this kind of...
I just keep thinking. So I mean, because even though I don't know the end, I guess I always know, you know, a few chapters ahead. So I always know the problem that's about to face me. So it means that, and I'm thinking, well, it's okay. Hopefully, it will come to me by the time I get to that. So, and I find when I'm driving or when I'm walking or when I'm in the shower, those ideas eventually come. I can always remember the exact intersection where I was in Sydney, where I pulled up at the lights and I was waiting for the lights to change, and I worked out how in The Husband's Secret I had those the different stories and how I would bring them all together, and the euphoria of working that out.
I can't tell you how much gas I've wasted from, you know, I, a lot of writers tell me, oh, it came to me in the car, so I just drive around. I'm I'm waiting for it.
just driving around.
Just driving around waiting.
I think it's when you do go into that meditative state. You know how when you get somewhere and you don't remember getting there because you were thinking so much. But everybody's come, so it doesn't. But see, now I said it out loud, it probably won't ever happen again, because if you start thinking, oh, come on, I do, it won't happen.
Well, I guess the point is your subconscious mind is smarter than your conscious mind, and whatever your subconscious comes up with is brilliant, and, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
You try to
over-engineer. Well, I can't say what I was about to say, that in the book, the treatment program offered by Masha, sort of, it's meant to be tapping into that subconscious mind, yeah.
Right.
Which we know so little about.
Yeah, that had given me another idea in the book. I'm like, maybe that's my answer.
Yeah, maybe you don't know, and I've thought about that for future books, too.
Right.
I don't think I should encourage that.
It didn't work with my college papers, I'll tell you that. My guest is Leanne Moriarty, the book Nine Perfect Strangers. So we've kind of talked around this question, but I guess we can hit it directly about living in the world as a writer. Aside from living in the world, aside from sitting down at your computer screen and all the time that takes, but, you know, it sounds like you are just a very keen observer of the world, and you take in all these situations to kind of immerse yourself in the next idea. But I was wondering if you had any sort of guidance or whatever about just living in the world as like your writerly point of view as you walk through life. Does that make sense?
Yes. I don't know that I do. Because I sort of hate myself when I think, when I become aware of, oh, look at you, you're observing them. Look at you being a writer observing them. And so I think it's actually important not to be aware of that, and just to live my life. So I almost have no answer to that, except that I do wish I'm not constantly losing my notebook. I should take more notes. But then often the notes that I take aren't that good anyway. So I think... just doing different things and doing new experiences, I think, help, and having conversations with, you know, people from all walks of life, I think that helps. Yeah, just opening myself up to new experiences, because you can't get new ideas just sitting at your computer. Having said that, if you said, what are these new experiences, I don't know that I can't actually name any.
Did you do a health retreat for the research of the book?
I did, but I didn't suffer very much from my art. I did a very nice, comfortable one, and I wrote while I was there. So actually, that's an example, see, really, where I felt guilty about that, where I kept thinking you should go off and do one of those really crazy health retreats, and I kept thinking, no, I don't want to. I just I did get material from going to this one, just funny little things like the resort manager telling me about somebody having a meat lover's pizza delivered to the back fence, which I put in the novel. But I didn't go to one where I starved. I just kept thinking, I can imagine that without actually having to do it.
Just skip lunch and that's enough. That's what I say.
That's right. That was enough to do it.
I'm suffering. Yeah, I have a friend who does these once a year. She goes, I think she's made it up to like 17 days without food. And then they also do these really awful, aggressive hikes. And yeah, and she comes back saying she's, you know, spiritually changed. And I said, I'm just going to take your word for it because that's just.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I find it so, that's just so fascinating to me. But yes, I feel like on the second day, I'd say that's it.
That's it.
I'll have lunch.
That's right. That's right. maybe the other answer is to have a sister who, I read that you had a sister who published before you, which sort of spurred you into competition.
Yes, it absolutely did. So she's the author, Jacqueline Moriarty, and it's definitely all due to her. So when we were little, we both wanted to be writers. But as I got older, I wrote less and less, and just first chapters that didn't go anywhere. And ended up with a career in advertising and marketing, so writing advertising copy. And it was when I can clearly remember when she told me that her first book had been accepted, that I was just filled with envy that she'd gone ahead and achieved our childhood dream, and I hadn't even given it a shot. So I'm so grateful to her for doing it first. And now there are six children. And our youngest sister is also now an author as
well. Oh, my God. Were your parents big influencers of the arts?
No, we're definitely a family with always with books around, but not in any way an academic family. So, you know, my father had bookshelves filled with lots of airport thrillers, and we were always taken to the library and encouraged to read, but not encouraged in that... this is good for you, you know, or read the classics. It was just read. My grandmother had a bookshelf filled with, Dickens, but my father had the airport thrillers, and I would pick one up after the other and not see much difference between the two. Not an academic family, and my parents are not by any means writers, but they're both storytellers. They both tell a great story. So I think that maybe influenced us.
Very cool. Do you have a lot of abandoned books in the drawer? Do you ever abandon projects, and how do you know kind of when it's time to do that, if you do that?
I do have a lot of abandoned first chapters, maybe, but I haven't got that far, though. First or second or third chapters, maybe as far as that. But mostly because I'm rewriting what I've done the day before. I'm not somebody who does one draft and who can say I do however many drafts of my books, because I'm constantly redrafting as I go. So I don't have that many abandoned projects. But the ones that I do, I do find that they find their way into other books, and then if I click through some of my old documents, I think, oh, that's where that idea started. I've forgotten that.
That's going to be such an encouraging thing for writers to hear, that, if you do have to feel like you're tossing something away, maybe it'll resurface someplace else so people don't feel like...
Yes, definitely. I think it almost always does. So I don't think it's ever wasted, any writing that you do. I really don't think it is.
That's going to be the best thing anybody has heard on this show. No writing is wasted. Oh, we're out of time. Is there anything we should have, any advice that we should have allowed you to get out that we didn't?
No, I don't, not, not that I can think of, just to enjoy it. I always think we should, as writers, we should all remember to enjoy it. And once you're enjoying it, I think that's when you lose your sense of self, which is always the aim, isn't it? To keep writing until you've disappeared and you're just in the story.
Yeah.
So just have fun with it. It's meant to be fun.
It's so hard to do that. People, you know, it's such a love-hate thing.
Because you do seem to have to do that self-loathing and the flailing about and the agonizing part. So I haven't actually worked out how to, the shortcut to the good bit yet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we all have a very clean refrigerator when we're doing it, so that's good.
Yes, that's right.
Leanne Moriarty, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
No, it's a pleasure for me too. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you.
That was Leanne Moriarty. Her book, 9 Perfect Strangers, is out and available now. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Mark Gillade will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Writers on Writing. You can always visit Barbara's website, Pen on Fire, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I am bringing on now Mark Russell Gillade with his debut collection, Navigating by Stars. Mark Russell Gillade was born in London, England, raised in Montreal, Canada, and is a 30-year resident of San Francisco. He's the past winner of the world's best short story contest, sponsored by Florida State University. His short fiction has appeared in Narrative Magazine, Southeast Review, Fiction Attic, and several other literary e-zines. He holds an MA in Poetics from New College of California, where he studied with Gloria Frim, Adam Cornford, and the late David Meltzer. He's currently finalizing a manuscript of poetry called Another Life, but today we're talking about Navigating by Stars, 24 very short stories of love and longing. You all know my love of flash fiction, so this is an extra treat. Mark, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So I love the introduction in this book that kind of sets the stage, and you certainly don't have to read it, but if you can kind of take us into how this collection came to be, it's a fascinating story. So let's kind of start there and let you talk about how Navigating by Stars came to be.
Well, I had previously been studying poetry. I hadn't been considered myself a fiction writer. And I think I wrote the first short in the collection quite by accident. I was at my writing desk, and a voice just kind of inhabited me. And if that wasn't strange enough, it was the voice of a woman in the midst of an emergency home birth. And I just kind of went with it. And when it was over, I had a page and a half of writing, which felt to me strangely complete. And it felt kind of not quite like a prose poem, and maybe something along the lines of flash fiction, but had a different character arc, and definitely for me it was unusual to write in a female voice.
Yeah, you are so wonderful at writing from the female point of view, and I love the story about this entering a contest, and the judge was Robert Olin Butler, who's been on the show in the past, and he said that he wanted to meet the woman who wrote this. I love that story.
Yeah, that's right. As I said, when I finished that story, I kind of just looked at it and thought, well, what the heck was that? And it was like a month or so later, and I came across a call for submissions for something called the World's Best Short Story Contest. And I thought, something with a presumptuous contest name as that, I said, I'm going to enter that, because the word limit was 500 words. And so I was very close to that. I had like 480 words or whatever it was. And I tightened it up, mailed it in, and really didn't think much more about it. And then a few months later, I was in my car driving home from some errands, and it was Florida State University saying, hey, this is Florida State University. I'm calling to tell you won the World's Best Short Story Contest, and Robert Olin Butler is really looking forward to the woman who wrote it. And he was like, oh, wait a minute, you're not a woman. And, yeah, there's some authenticity that I can't quite explain that kind of came through her voice, and certainly she was dealing with a situation which I, of course, had never personally experienced. But there you have it.
Well, the day's young. You never know.
Yeah.
um, So then talk about the rest of this. So you kind of had that win in your pocket, and then talk about your decision to kind of keep going with this and what that looked and felt like.
Well, I think that the definitely, you know, winning the contest was really, you know, kind of gave me some validation and a sense of confidence that I said, hey, this is maybe a form that I could really explore more. And I'm not a quick writer. I'm a slow writer, and slowly started chipping away at, you know, whatever inspiration hit me, another voice came through. And I mean, it was maybe a year or so later, another female voice came through, and then another voice came through that I realized was a counterpart to the story in this other story called If by Postcard. And so along with the first person narratives came this organic kind of interrelationship between some of the characters as they moved into the foreground and others moved into the background. Mm-hmm. And that was something that also kind of kept me interested in the project.
Right, right. So over the course of what time period were these written, would you say?
Well, the first one was written in 2004, and I'd say most of them were written over the next eight or 9 years because I've rewritten them about 100,000 times.
Sure.
Yep.
That's how it goes. And as you look across the arc of the stories, I see a lot of themes emerging, but were you kind of consciously aware of some of those themes? I mean, there's certainly a sort of an astral, you know, navigating by the stars is the first piece in this, but that theme certainly plays out in a lot of these pieces. Was that something that you were like, okay, this needs to be kind of a cohesive set, so I need to kind of keep my eye on you know, some of the crosshairs through some of these stories?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I can't really say to what degree I consciously kind of willed it to all come together to, you know, so that there would be some of organic, coherent feeling throughout the collection. But there certainly ended up being that, and I would say that there's a similar, at least with the stories that do have that kind of sort of intimate feeling, the characters are at some sort of spiritual crossroads. And it was the characters who were kind of embracing some change in their life, either a divorce, betrayal, or some other kind of large life circumstance. Those were the characters that kind of interested me.
Yeah.
So I think that structurally, I think the thing that kind of works, in my view at least, in a good short, is that there is, you know, a character arc. And then there is a situational dynamic that has to be engaging for readers. And then finally, there has to be the language that brings it all together. And in my case, situational dynamic was kind of a spiritual yearning, I think, for most of the characters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's incredible that you can accomplish that much in that compressed time frame. I'm such a lover, as our listeners know, of the flash fiction form. But these are even almost shorter than a lot of, you know, these are even less than 1,000 words in a lot of cases. And
yeah.
I guess a lot of that comes from your training as a poet, that you can say a lot less or a lot more in a lot fewer words, perhaps. But I was just boggling at some of these, what you were able to accomplish in just, you know, 1.5 or 2 pages. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Is that something that, I mean, I assume you sort of tend to write short given your poetry background, but were a lot of these longer and it was a matter of whittling them down and compressing them, or is that just kind of the natural mindset that you have, is working in sort of this 500 to 1,000 word bursts?
I think it was a combination. I definitely kind of leaned towards the short views of things, and of course the background as a poet, I've always kind of focused on a sort of compression of language in some ways. And in this case, I did a lot of noodling just to find just the right amount of compression that I could get as much emotion into the stories with as few amount of words as possible. And I think a lot of the rewriting had to do with just that, trying to compress the story down to its essential core and still have the voice be very genuine that
sure.
was speaking. That was kind of important to me too.
Yeah, sure. You also do most all of these, maybe I'd have to go back and look, but a lot of these are in first person point of view. And that to me gives you a lot of immediate access to a character that I think in flash fiction or in really compressed short shorts is even more important. I mean, you really have to dive into this person's mind very quickly. And that first person point of view, I hadn't really thought about that until I was reading this collection, but it really serves that immediacy.
I totally agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that, and in poetry, there's a lot of second person, but also, you know, first person and second person. But, you know, you're able to do things, I think, in that point of view, you know, in the short form that I think is really interesting. I don't know if you ever, do you experiment at all with the third person, or is that too far away?
Well, I do, but I think in this case, the way that the characters kind of came to me, it was just as if they were speaking to me. And I think one of the lessons I taught myself over the years of writing these was kind of just to move out of the way in some respects when a voice came through, and it, you know, giving it that first, having that first person perspective to start with, that's kind of that was kind of the cornerstone of the whole collection, that everybody was talking in the first person. And then you would hear characters who at the one point in the story are saying something about their situation. You can draw your own conclusions as to what they're saying. And then further down in the stories, you might find another character also speaking as forthrightly and honestly as they possibly can about their situations, but you realize that they're actually responding in some ways to another story in the collection.
Yeah.
And that's kind of fun to find those aha moments where you think about, wait a minute, I know who this guy is.
Right. Those are fun.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I was talking to Karen Bender last, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, and she has this octopus theory about creating scope in very short stories. And so she said to give a story scope, you have, you know, the body of the story, and then the writer throws out a tentacle either into the past or into the future to give the sense that these characters have a much wider life outside the scope of the story, and, you know, kind of give the reader that feeling that these characters could walk off the page at any point and, you know, live their lives. And so I've been reading things kind of through that lens since she said that, and great use of that here. I guess you almost have to do that when you when you're writing in this sort of compressed time frame. But even in a page or page and a half, these characters seemed like they had such full and rich and, you know, vibrant lives and deep relationships outside of, you know, 500 words. And anyway, I don't know if you've had thoughts on how you have managed to create that or if it is sort of organic, but anyway, it was very effective.
Yeah, I've often been asked, well, these characters, why don't you just write a novel? Take one of these stories and turn it into a novel. And I think, okay, well, I could do that, but that wasn't my project. That wasn't what I was interested in. I was really interested in, like you said, that moment where there's so much going on and you're getting that, you know, within a couple of pages. The other thing about it that I think a successful short story that has some kind of lingering impact is that the ending kind of opens into something else. And I think that that also, I think, is my poetry kind of slant coming into it as well. And sometimes in a good poem, you know, when you end a poem, there's a sense of something else, an expansiveness. And I think I'm lucky that I could achieve that once in a while in some of the short stories where the story ends, but there's something else that kind of opens up. And I think the Bridges Down is one of those stories, the first one I wrote, that kind of had that feeling at the end of it when I was done. I was like, wow, you know, that lingers on somewhere.
Yes, yes. Well, that's a good segue into it. Why don't we read The Bridges Down? These stories are short enough that we can actually read them on the air. And then we'll use that as a jumping off point to kind of talk about some of the decisions you made when you were writing it. Can you read that for us?
Sure, happy to. The Bridges Down. The rain has been driving down for 12 straight hours. The radio says anyone on the floodplain should get ready to evacuate. The river is an angry torrent of mud, broken branches, and fractured limbs. Flash floods are pretty much the norm this time of year. But things will change after the storm. You just know it. The contraction started last night, and I told Bill it was just my luck the heavens should burst open right about the same time I was going to. We've already settled on a name. If it's a girl, we'll call her Ginger. If it's a boy, William Jr., after his dad. Bill's got the route planned out. We'll head through town, across the bridge, past the post office, and on down US 101. Bill has phone in one hand and the radio tucked under his arm. Every minute or so, he cranes his neck to glance back at me from across the hall. The pain is pulling me down, pulling me to another place in my brain where I can smell wet earth and feel the heat of my own blood gushing through my veins. Another pang, and a fine sheen of sweat forms on my forehead. The rain is falling with a deep drumming groan on the yard. The ground is more liquid than land right now, and I'm thinking that at any moment the whole house will lift on a swell of water and float into town. I might lift and float slowly into town. Bill worked at the local lumber mill until it closed down last year. We're in transition, as they say. Only the little cosmic joke on us was that, ready or not, we were pregnant. Bill, I call out, shut the heater. I'm burning up here. The body I used to know and understand is undergoing some seriously dark changes. Deep roots twisting and pulling at me like a trunk being hauled out of the earth. My fists are clenching the sheets, my belly about as round as a planet. Bill, it's getting close. We got to get going. Dan hands through his hair, cupping the phone. Honey, he tells me, the bridge is down. We're going to have to do this here. There are enough people looking in on me now. You think this was some kind of circus attraction. Bill's mom is gripping my hand. The rain is pouring in from the ends of the earth, but it's my own water that is broken now. There is water everywhere, inside and out, sweat and rain and urine, and through it all, the only one among us who can breathe through water is coming blindly across its own bridge, coming out for air, crying out for air.
That was Mark Russell Gillade reading from the book Navigating by Stars, the story The Bridge is Down. So this started, so this woman's voice came to you. I want to just unpack this because I've tried to get characters to speak to me in this clarity before and it just never happened. So were you like driving or something? Because a lot of ideas I think bubble up when we're kind of least thinking about them, or sort of talk about that moment when she started speaking to you.
No, I was at my writing desk, obviously, and I just, you know, got the whiff of this sense of this character coming into my psyche, and you know, it's a hard thing to really articulate, to say that there is something that you can do to will a character to come forward. I'm not saying this happens every time I sit down and write. Obviously, it doesn't. But the times that it does, there are some things that happen. In the introduction of the book, I kind of just called it like a lucky kind of magic in some ways, in that, you know, you have this little like scent in the air, and you follow it, and you try to get out of the way as much as possible. I probably sat there very quietly, just letting this voice come through me and say, okay, well, what's going on? What's happening? And I can't say that I planned it all, but what happens, if you're lucky, you get a very organic piece of writing that comes together. And I didn't really plan that there would be, you know, the breaking of the water with the birth, and the rain is happening at the same time, and there's a sense of a bridge is down. Those were the, I'd say, the lucky ingredients that kind of created the organic feel that I think readers get when they read that story.
So did it go through a lot of revision processes, or was this really just kind of one of those lucky, you sit down, you write it, and it just comes out right the first time?
Yeah, this one did just come out as it is. As I said, it might have been a couple of words over 500 words when I had the first draft, but once I saw that ad for the contest, I made sure it was like 499 words, tightening up a little bit, and that's where it ended up. And I don't really recall that, you know, I rewrote it or wrote it that extensively, because it was one of those pieces that almost a character just kind of came out and did a soliloquy.
I love that the description that you're having of the story's birth is mirrored in the birth of, you know, in the content of the story of this woman giving mm-hmm. birth, that it almost mm-hmm. feels like that, this urgency and this kind mm-hmm. of, you know, wave that you can't stop. And it's just wonderful. So in terms of titles, I think a lot of your titles came from phrases in some of the stories. Talk a little bit about titling and, you know, kind of if the titles were easy for you. I mean, titles are so hard, and I feel like now you have to not just name the book, but you have to come up with now 24 new titles. So was that? Tell me a little bit about that process and finding the right resonant note, because I feel like titles have to do a you know, a couple of different jobs in a story.
Yeah, you know, I wish I could say to you, I know how to do this, and let me explain how it's done. I really can't say that, but I will say that with the story, there is something to work on, and finding kind of like a musical sort of correspondence to the story is something that kind of worked out in this collection. I will say with my own poetry, I sometimes find it actually harder to come up with titles for poems than I do with the short stories. And a couple of them change titles over time, but Somehow, the notion of the stars, of course, came through. There's a story called Lucky Stars. There's Navigating by Stars. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I wish I could say that there, here's how you do it. This is the formula. I kind of just riff off of the story and kind of find what that title is that even reinforces really, I think, what is going on in the story. For instance, there's a story called All That I Desire, and as an example, there's a woman talking and she's, you know, explaining kind of sort of flirtatious relationship she's having with a coworker, and I think, you know, the title is something that hopefully hits at the kind of the white hot center of the story if it's really successful.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There are a couple of other bridges in here too. I was looking at, when I was thinking about the bridges down, I was also thinking about, there's another story in here called Floating in the Gray, which is about two men crossing the Golden Gate Bridge as they do over and over. And they're both kind of lost and at sea. And, you know, this image of, San Francisco in the mist, yeah, it is. It's really pleasurable for the reader and probably for the writer, too, to find these resonances across stories that may not be directly on point with each other, but still feel like they're kind of talking to each other. And that's got to be fun for you, too, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it is. And sometimes I think I just start writing a voice. And, for instance, with Floating in the Gray, it has a corollary in another story called Lucky Stars.
Yeah.
So, and sometimes the story will start and I will think to myself, hey, that character belongs in another story. And I know that. And I can sort of somehow I can wrangle that a little bit. And that's kind of what happened between Floating in the Gray and Lucky Stars. Mm-hmm. One story talks about a friend who's kind of on the ropes and is thinking of changing his life. And the other story is that friend talking in the first person about what they're perspective of the experiences in their life.
So cool. So cool. I am talking with Mark Russell Gilead, the book Navigating by Stars. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUZI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Do you set up little like challenges or frameworks for yourself? I mean, the word count itself is one of those where I feel like if you put boundaries around yourself, sometimes it's easier for a writer. And I was just thinking, you know, if there are other things like that, you do sort of setting up challenges to help some of these stories out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't really sort of not guided by word count as much as maybe it's just my need for instant gratification. So if I start writing a piece, I like to see that it kind of reaches a destination, you know, within a reasonable amount of time.
Uh-huh.
And short stories, that's kind of where my sort of needle on my compass kind of leans to. And I've written a couple of other stories subsequently that aren't in the first person, have a different kind of tone to them, but they're also on the short side, so, you know, 3 to 4 pages at the most. And that just seems to be my aesthetic and where currently, you know, my writing is kind of settled.
And do you routinely send out to journals and contests? There's so many wonderful flash fiction contests out there, and that's one thing that kind of keeps, I think, writers motivated is that you can get feedback pretty quickly and you can get yeses and nos much easier than you do with the novel process.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I sent out a bunch of these over the years and had a little, I would say, moderate success in getting a few of them placed. And Narrative Magazine took a story called, it was originally called Tattoos for You, and they renamed it to the title story, Navigating by Stars, which was fine. And Fiction Addict took one. I think that's true. It is good to get stories out, and it's good to get the yes and no quickly so you can move on to the next magazine.
Yeah.
And also, I think for writers, you know, that kind of is kind of important in terms of the goal of publishing the whole collection is to try to get as many out there singles as you can.
Right, right, right. Oh, God, we're drawing down on time. But I love Navigating by Stars so much. I love that story so much. I wonder if we could just end on you reading that to us. And the ending of that just made me tear up. So I would... I'd love to just end on that, if you wouldn't mind reading that to us, too.
Sure, happy to.
Thanks.
Navigating by Stars. Harry, Stan, and Peg. Their names still legible on a wooden roadside memorial. looks like someone's left fresh flowers. 1 year ago to the day, they'd headed down from Bolinas and across the Golden Gate Bridge to San Francisco to get tattoos and piercings. Stan and Peg hadn't stopped talking about it all week, what they would get, where they would get it. Stan was thinking of going with something tribal, maybe an armband or calf band. Peg had settled on a crimson butterfly angled slightly on her right shoulder. And Harry? Harry wasn't much interested in tattoos. He was thinking about getting his ear pierced, probably daydreaming about studs and rings. That summer, they had each arrived at a turning point. Stan announced that he was done being a handyman and was going to get his contractor's license. Peg was thinking about marrying Stan, though he hadn't asked her yet. And I think my brother Harry had finally made up his mind to leave Bolinas altogether, apply to college, and get his degree. The phone had rung at an awkward hour, too late at night to be good news. Stan was driving, Peg seated next to him, then Harry, his head resting on his palm, probably gazing out the passenger window. Winding back up the mountain road toward home, Stan had misjudged the curve, and with too little room for correction, the pickup had careened over the steep ravine and dropped down into the moonlit surf below, a skid mark arcing across the lanes like a black rainbow. I was the one who had talked Harry into getting the piercing. I thought he could use a little something to spruce up his image. He'd been all gloom and doom lately. I recommended a diamond stud. Nothing outrageous, just a firm but understated emblem of his counterculture status. I actually thought it might help him a bit with the girls, since he wasn't breaking any records in that department either. Now the only broken record to speak of is the one that keeps running through my head whenever I can't fall asleep at night. My dear brother, I tremble as the stars come out and night falls. You out there falling through air. Peg's long hair lifting, fluttering against your face, the sudden absence of road noise. And although the story of your brief life leads only to this gravel-dusted cross etched with your name, I know you would have risen above the ravine as the truck went airborne. You would have kept on going, too, and not looked down. You would have fixed your green eyes steadfastly on the brightest star in the night sky and risen to meet it, just like any other future.
That was Mark Russell Gillade reading Navigating by Stars. Actually, that's the title story, Navigating by Stars. That is the perfect, perfect ending. I love that ending. Thank you. This was wonderful. And we can find you online. You have a wonderful website, which is your name, markrussellgillade.com. And are there other ways we can stalk you online?
Oh, that's probably the best way. And it's really been a pleasure talking to you too, Mary. I really, really enjoyed it.
This was wonderful. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Great. Thank you.
And that was Writers on Writing. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for Jazzy Rhythms coming up next. A lot of jazz in your KUCI future. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next week at 9 a.m.